Record button. There you go. This meeting's being recorded. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing a dear friend, an old friend, by the name of Mickler Bishop. Mickler's going to wave to you. There we go. He's got an MB on his screen. I met Mickler back in the day when I studied very briefly with Albert Ellis. And Mickler was getting knee deep in Albert Ellis, running groups there and workshops. He's written a couple of books on addictions, and he's always been an extreme supporter of Division, APA Division 50, our division, and a member. Through many years of work and experience and a passion for the research we do on addictions, Mickler has studied self-guided change, and he's got some, I think, valuable things to say about it. And Mickler's slides are in my hands. He's going to tell me to pop onto the first slide here now, and we're going to get started. And again, if you have a question, unmute yourself and say, "Excuse me, can I ask a question?" So there you have it. Feel free. And Mickler will try to end 10 minutes beforehand so that you can. 5 or 10 minutes, so you can answer questions. All right. I am going to share my screen. And Dr. Mickler Bishop, welcome. And please tell us everything you know about what researchers and practitioners can learn from self-guided change.
Thank you very much. And I hope all of you are well out there in this really trying time. I do want to thank Division 50. And Bruce is right, I've been a member for a long time. I especially want to thank Dr. Lease for putting this talk series together and for giving me an opportunity to share some thoughts about self-guided change, which, of course, is also known as natural recovery. I've been a clinician for over 30 years. But I've always tried very hard to have my practice be informed by what the research suggested works best. In this talk, I'm going to focus on 5 points. I think we could learn a great deal from people who change their behavior, who recover, although that's not a term that I really like, often on their own. Number two, I think clinicians like me would find that information very helpful. Three, I think there's a reasonably inexpensive research tool available now that could help us find out how people change and how they maintain that change. Four, there are various factors, I think, that have to come together before a lapse or relapse occurs. And what I call the surprise factor and something called metastability can sometimes derail people's best efforts to maintain a behavior change. Finally, fortunately, revolutionary changes in psychotherapy make modern therapy and counseling much more effective than traditional therapy and counseling was. And I think counselors and therapists could help accelerate self-guided change. I do have 2 goals. One is, as you may have noticed, I ain't young. So I'm hoping there's some young researcher out there who might find this area interesting, as Linda and Mark Sobel did many, many years ago, and they recently won an award, APA award for, or ABCT, I can't remember, for lifetime achievement. Some of it into research into natural recovery. And of course, I'm always hoping to help people who are not severely addicted not become severely addicted and derail their entire life. I see people, all kinds of people at the Institute, now of course locked up in my New York apartment virtually. Some of them are over drinking, some of them are depressed, anxiety disorders, opioid medication misuse, phone sex, pornography addiction, bipolar disorder, relationship issues. And it does give me kind of a catbird seat because I'm seeing a bunch of different people with different disorders into how people change and how people don't change. In terms of addiction, I do work primarily with people who are over drinking, a term which I like and I wish were in the literature. It suggests that people have a limit, as they do. Overspending, for example, exists in Google, over sleeping, overeating, obviously. And it suggests that we have a limit in mind, but that we somehow went beyond that limit, as many of us know at the end of a meal where we are intending not to eat dessert and then our partner eats dessert. And, well, we eat dessert too. Same thing can happen on a vacation where you go beyond the budget that you had expected or hoped to spend. When I started many years ago, Alan Marlatt had just written his groundbreaking book, 1985. And when we started SMART in the 1990s, it was a very different world. The younger people at the talk at a hospital about SMART, at that time called Rational Recovery, but it morphed into SMART. And as I was standing after the talk at the elevator, somebody came up with a very intense look on his face and said, "You know, you're going to kill people. There is only one way to get over alcoholism, and that is AA. You have to stop and you have to go to AA." And it really did take me aback. And I remember putting up flyers for SMART, and they would be ripped down. Fortunately, that has changed. I remember also back in 1992, Charlotte Castle wrote a book in which she said that women essentially got a message of powerlessness multiple times during the day, and they did not need to go to a meeting where the first thing you had to do was admit that you were powerless. So as I was working, beginning to work, I also noticed that many people who came in, let's say, over drinking, had also stopped heroin, sometimes on their own. And they'd stopped, or they had stopped using cocaine, often on their own. And I got fascinated by, how is this possible? Because it certainly didn't jibe with everything I had seen in the media, and even what I'd learned in getting my PhD. So I started to look at the literature, and if you'll go to the next slide, please, Bruce, on what is called natural recovery most of the time in the literature, and in the medical literature, spontaneous remission. I don't like the term natural recovery because I don't think there's anything really natural about it. Even the term recovery, people who stop smoking don't think of themselves in recovery. People who give up gambling or moderate their gambling don't see themselves as in recovery. There's usually nothing spontaneous about it either. Most people, it takes a lot of time. It takes effort. It has to be very intentional, very purposeful. It often involves other people. So it doesn't just happen spontaneously. At least if it does, it's pretty rare. And of course, I don't like the term maturing out because it has a stigma kind of attached to it that you were immature before. Could you go to the next slide, please? Fortunately, in 2014, Esser and her associates published a study, which I really found fascinating, of 138,000 people. And when I looked very closely at the numbers and then also the total population in the United States, it turned out that about 64 million people binge drink at least once per month. And another slide shows that 88,000 people die per year from binge drinking. Now, that, I'm not quite finished with the slide yet. Okay, so in the 65 plus group, only 4 million still reported binge drinking. You may go, oh, well, of course, they got older, they got wiser, they stopped it. But for me, it was like, well, wait a minute, how did they do that? Since I'm pretty sure, you can go to the next slide, which is a graph of those numbers. And even the next slide, which shows that even alcohol-dependent people, even though the millions peaks at about somewhere in the 30s, it goes down. Of course, some of those people died, that's for sure, but not all of them. Next slide, please. And according to Esser, most of these people were not alcohol-dependent, based on the DSM-4. They were not addicted, but as I noted before, 88,000 deaths per year just to binge drinking. Next slide, please. In addition, it's probably true that not many people went for treatment. First of all, most people, we know from the research, don't think they need treatment. Most people, again, we know from the research, don't want to go for treatment, or they can't. They don't have the money, or they can't leave their family. And most people don't think treatment would help. So next slide, please. This just shows that smokers do the same thing. The number of people who smoke goes down. How do these, that's fine, the next one. How do these changes in difficult-to-change behaviors occur? What strategies do people use to initiate change? And what strategies do they use to maintain the change? Those are the kind of questions that have fascinated me. Reed Hester went to a workshop I did at APA probably 30 years ago. I was fascinated by those questions. I still am. And I'm hoping some people, has not been much research in the last 20 years. The story on natural recovery or self-guided change starts over, what do we got, 40, 20, almost 60 years ago, when Winnick reported, to most people's surprise, that 75% of people mature out, people using heroin, mature out by their late 30s. Take to the next slide, please. This is probably one of the most famous studies. It really jarred people, and most people simply didn't believe it. Robbins and her associates were hired by the Defense Department. The Defense Department was really alarmed. It knew that many people in Vietnam were addicted to heroin, and they expected a flood of heroin addicts to flow back into the country, making matters even worse since our country was very divided at that time as well. So she interviewed people, and what she found out is that on their return without treatment, and that's the key piece here, the rates of addiction returned to about 1%. Some probably became addicted to something else like alcohol. Budweiser was not readily available in the swamps of Vietnam. She was attacked. And in 1993, if you really want to read a wonderful, well-written, well-reasoned article, 1993, she answered all of the various attacks that had occurred over the past 10, 20 years. 1994, Erickson and his associates reported finding that 1 year later, 16 of 54 untreated cocaine users had stopped. Next slide. And same year, Cohen and Sass, 4 years after an initial interview, 64 of 160 participants had stopped. Only 6% had sought treatment. So these studies caught my eye. Finally, in 1996, Linda and Mark Sobel did two studies, one very large, 11,000 people. They asked people who responded to a newspaper article, advertisement, how many of you resolved the difficulties with alcohol on your own without treatment? And the answer was 77%. And again, that really caught my attention. Next slide, please. A year later, Strang and his associates, looking at opioid users, of the 19 participants who were still using, 65 were injecting less often and using less and using fewer different types of drugs. Next, please. The best study, as far as I'm concerned, in the last 20 years has been by Tony Otto and the Sobels, where they interviewed people. 50 had resolved their difficulties, mean abstinence of 3.7 years. 21 hadn't. Next slide, please. And when I looked at that and found that 38% said it was somewhat or extremely easy to change their behavior, again, I think shocked. Next slide. I looked at the reasons for quitting, and it's not surprising now. This is 20 years ago. What seems obvious now is not so obvious then. Next slide. Next slide, please. Bruce, yeah, thanks. So then they also asked, how did you maintain your decision to stop? And these are not unusual now. We understand people change their friends, change social life, et cetera, change drug use. Next slide. And I think we skipped a slide, but it's okay. So in 2000, because I'm interested in not only how did they, you know, why did they change, what helped them initiate change, and then what helps them maintain change. But we can go to the next slide. 20 years ago, Walters did a meta-analytic review and found that the remission rates were somewhere between 14 and 50%, depending on your definition. And here again, he was looking at what I call self-guided change. He called it spontaneous remission. I thought it also interesting that he found that it differed depending on the drug. Next, please. 2011, 11 years later, Lopez Quintero and her associates, again, shocking to me, 50% of cocaine users had quit 5 years after being dependent on cocaine. 99% of whites, 98% of African Americans, 94% of Hispanics eventually quit. And there again, you get this, and only 11% got treatment. So people out there know how to do this. Next, please. And 2 years later, Blanco and his associates looking at heroin users found that 50% stopped in 45 years and 96% eventually stopped. When I talk to people, lay people, friends about this, they just look at me in total disbelief. They can't believe it. I, in fact, tried to get an editor at Guilford to publish a book. And she said, I just don't understand it. How can this happen? I said, I'm not telling you that it's happening. The research, 60 years of research is telling me it's happening. And people are walking around thinking you're doomed if you get addicted to heroin, for example. Well, this research suggests something quite different. The next slide, please. So if we kind of summarize this, number one, we find most people recover, often on their own. It's true, many people spend years engaging in addictive behaviors and avoid seeking help from treatment providers and self-help groups. I don't think we currently offer many treatment options for these particular kinds of people. We offer intense treatment options for people who are very dependent on alcohol, but not for people who are out there who want to change their behavior, who are working, have families, etc. There are apps and websites, one of them being Reed Hester's Checkup and Choices and the Sobel's I Self Change. And there are many more. I would say somewhere around 10% of them show real promise, particularly those, for example, at Carnegie Mellon that are using human machine learning to predict overeating, et cetera. As needed, on-demand counseling, or what I call sporadic therapy, might also help. Next, please. I just threw this slide in because I have a lot of young people who in my classes now have 1, 2, 3, 4 diagnoses. And often I have 2 or 3 or 4 women who have been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. So I show them this slide, which shows that after 2 years, 34% are in remission, 4 years, 49, 6 years, 68. Next slide, please. Overall, 73% remit, and the relapse rates are very, very low. They are stunned. They believe that a personality disorder was something fixed. And those of you who are interested in the history of personalities as opposed to characters, William James was more fascinated in that whole period, the last 30 years of the 19th century. Was fascinated by characteristics, and we're circling back now. We're trying to help people become more resilient, which is a characteristic, where personalities are seen as kind of fixed, and people with a personality disorder often think, and I really wouldn't care, except that these young people often have decided they can't do what they had dreamed of doing because they have this terrible disorder. So this slide really helps them kind of think about things slightly differently, or maybe dramatically differently. Next slide, please. So, just try to stay on track. I can wander off. Occasionally I'm at a party and somebody says, they look at me and they say, do people really change? And if I'm in the right mood, I say, no, but I take their money anyway. It seems like such an amazing question and a kind of offensive question, right? But I've heard it so often that finally I decided I'm going to try to look at the literature and see, so what happens with six different behaviors, what I call risky health behaviors, alcohol, heroin misuse, cocaine misuse, gambling, nicotine, overeating, these that people use to moderate or abstain from alcohol. And you can see learning to refuse when offered a drink. There's a whole bunch of protective behavioral strategies, alternating drinks, drinking alcohol. And these, when I give this kind of a list to people who are trying to not overdrink or in my office, it's helpful. So I'm giving them a menu here. Try this. Next, please. And how do they maintain that change? Well, now, again, this research is 25 years old. It's probably good research, knowing the Savelles, but nonetheless, it should be replicated. Things could have changed in the last 20 years. The drinkers of 25 years ago may not be similar, or may not be similar in some ways to those that were there 25 years ago. Next, please. Before I go to that one, though, for this heroin, no, I want you to stay there. Thank you. I was talking with, emailing with Jay Lee Tucker, and we were talking about the fact that, and I'm sharing this because I've been in an office now for 30 years. Almost no one who comes into my office, and in fact, I cannot think of a single client who's come into my office wanting to moderate who was able to do so. That, I think, is because as Jay Lee Tucker in an article, it was King and Tucker 2000, found that people who had resolved their difficulties with alcohol, if they had wound up on moderation, they reported having tried moderation something like 4.6 times, 5.2 times, if I remember. However, if they wound up abstaining from alcohol, they reported, on average, trying moderation 46.3 times. And some of my clients laugh and say, oh, I've tried much more than that. If you want to moderate and can moderate, my bet is you'd never wind up in my office. You figure it out. You change, and I never see you. So if you're in my office, you probably can't do it. There's something about your genetic makeup, that's what I would argue, that you can't interact with that chemical and manage to do it in a moderate manner. That's just insight from my office. Anyway, so then I looked at heroin. Well, why do people change heroin? Nobody's asked. I think that's because they assume it's just so god-awful that nobody, you know, obviously you want to change because it's just so terrible. About 6 months ago, the New York Times did an article about men in Baltimore, mostly African-American, who had been using heroin for 30 or 40 years and were now dying because it's now mixed with fentanyl and they can't control it. It's like if somebody sold me a bottle of Jack Daniels, but it's got fentanyl mixed in it. Of course, I could die because I don't know what I'm consuming. It was a very interesting article in many respects, but what I did find most interesting was the first evidence that I had, and it wasn't in the clinical research literature, that people had been using heroin for 30 or 40 years, much the way my father drank alcohol for 50, 60 years. I think it would be good to find out why people change. Obviously, you know, people think that there's no reason. No, there's a reason that people use heroin, and it would be fine, I think, to find out why do they decide to stop. Next one. Next slide, please. Thank you. So what are the strategies they use to moderate or abstain? Again, look at the date, 1998. Well, they changed the route of administration, the amount used, et cetera, et cetera. Next, please. And how do they maintain the change? Well, now this is a little bit, it's only 17 years old. Belief that drugs worsen their life, not surprising, constructive, fulfilling lifestyle, et cetera. These are the reasons people gave that helped them maintain their change. Family support, for example, and 51% for heroin drug treatment. Next, please. Going back to Toniato, with regard to cocaine, we looked at those reasons before, so you can go to the next slide. This primary strategies used by people who moderate or abstain cocaine use. Now, could you go back to that previous slide, please? Next previous slide, please. Previous, right? Right. So we don't know. We don't know. There's a lot of people in New York still using cocaine, and now even crack during the pandemic. But we really don't know. Now, I'm a clinician. I'm not a researcher, so maybe I missed some research and you know about it. And please email me because I'm interested. And if you did the research and I missed it, I apologize. Obviously, I would have loved to have read it, but I missed it. In any case, next slide. So we know from two studies how people maintain the change. Improvement of self-concept, I'll talk about a little bit more later, but that's an interesting term. That's the term that they used. Next one, please. And it's just more of the same. Notice that 12-step helped 51% of people. That's a lot of people. Next, please. So then I looked at gambling. Again, very few studies, even though gambling has a very serious impact on somewhere between 4 and 6% of our population, particularly when it gets legalized. New Jersey just legalized marijuana, which I have not included in this study. I think it's going to be a problem for about 10 years until people kind of wake up and realize how to use it and how to not use it or moderate its use, which again, I don't know whether the literature is out there about that. In any case, as you can see, gambling, various reasons people stop. Next, please. And these are some of the strategies that they use. Most gamblers do not appear to abstain. They moderate. There's a number of studies that show that. Next, please. And this is how they report from one study, maintaining that change. Next, please. So now let's turn to overeating. Back in, I think, around 1957, they did a study at Yale University and published it. And basically the takeaway was that people who lose weight always regain it. Nobody can lose weight and keep it off. And there were a number of people so irritated by that about 20 years ago. So they started what's called the National Weight Loss Registry, people who have lost more than 30 pounds and kept it off for more than 5 years. Now, of course, you may have noticed that 99% of people stop doing construction right outside downstairs. 99% of people stop cocaine, but only 20% lose weight and keep it off. However, 20% is a lot of people since everybody eats. You don't have to use cocaine. So, you know, how do these people do it? And I don't know about you, but I personally find losing and keeping weight off really, really challenging. Seriously, as a psychologist, watching myself sometimes go right back and just do what I said I wasn't going to do an hour before, it's kind of fascinating. Of course, many of us have maintained our weight. When I was in my 20s, I routinely went to Boston. They made great donuts at 3 a.m. in the morning, and I would drive back to New Haven from Boston. I would buy a dozen, and I would eat the whole box. No problem. I don't even touch a donut now. So, you know, we change our behavior. Some changes are not as difficult as others. Next slide, please. So if you look at the National Weight Control Registry, and if you've never gone on their website, it's a great website. Yesterday I was working with a young woman who, after 9 years of being sober, went back to drinking. Things got really bad, and now she's back up on her feet again. Typical kind of New York situation, in an apartment, no job currently, had a good job, and she was working as a Pilates instructor. So she was in great shape. And she said, I know I'm just gained 10 pounds, which is 10% of her weight. I can't fit into my good clothes. And I said, why is that vanity? It's not vanity. This is very important to you. You are basically an athlete who makes money as a Pilates instructor, and 10 pounds is a huge difference. So she said, what do I do? I said, well, if you look at the data, 78% of people eat breakfast every morning. If I did that, I'd throw up. I can't eat anything. My mom had digestive problems. I have a digestive problem. My father had I can't do that. I said, well, 22% don't do it. So I'm just going to tell you what some people have found helps, and then you have to figure out what works for you. And so some of the ideas that I suggest are probably nuts for you, but some may help. For example, 75% of people weigh themselves at least one time per week. But you're a little OCD. I figured that one out. And that might not be a good idea for you, because you might wind up weighing yourself 5 times a day, and we know that's not going to help you lose weight. So in any case, these kinds of lists help me as a clinician help people figure out what to do when they want to change their behavior. Next slide, please. So what are our clinical needs? Well, we need to know more, in my opinion. I think I've made that point. We need to know more about how they initiate the change, how they maintain the change. And if we gave them a list, would that help? Because we don't really have any literature outside of motivational interviewing and the protective behavioral strategies literature. And then could we predict an episode of overdrinking? I think we could. We'll get back to that. Next slide, please. Oh, back it up a second. Well, you can leave it, that's fine. No, that's fine. So in 2017, I was trying to get a paper written about how I thought you could build an app to predict over drinking. And I kept putting in observations from my office, and the editors wouldn't stand for it. It didn't have any research backing, they said. One of the things that I had observed was that many people, good, well-meaning people, taking care of jobs and family, etc., occasionally, once a month, every 2 months, maybe once a week, went out not intending to overdrink, and it was a catastrophe, and they were always surprised. And so I started getting curious about that because I heard it so often. So I started reading the literature on forecasting weather. And you guys, you know, you may laugh, but the person who stood up in the British Parliament in 1854 after a terrible shipwreck, caught a ship coming all the way from Australia, they can see land and they sink. Something like 1,000 people died. He got up and he said, we could predict the weather. He was laughed out of Parliament. Ridiculous idea. I actually think that my behavior, and I'll bet Bruce's behavior, he's the only guy I can see right now. Thankfully, he has a good smile. this lecturing to people and you can't see their responses is really wild. But in any case, I'm getting used to it. You know, my wife pretty well knows what I'm going to do every day, except after 6 p.m. Then that's not so clear. And not so good on Saturday and Sunday. All right. So, but because I'm not like a hurricane, I behave pretty much again and again and again. As long as I don't croak, I'm going to keep doing it. Hurricanes behave once. And their behavior is very difficult to predict, but we have computers now that are so much better than 50 years ago, amazingly better. And if you think about it, if the same hurricane behaved a little bit differently, but again and again, then it would be much easier to predict what happened. So I decided, let me find out. This editor wants some research. I'll try to find the research. And I discovered Amazon's Mechanical Turk workers. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you can Google Amazon Mechanical Turk. You are looking at one, by the way. They will do all sorts of stuff for you for really depressing prices, meaning for 25 cents, for 50 cents. I paid them a lot of money, 50 cents, to do a short survey. I put the survey on 11 p.m. and I linked it with Qualtrics. 6 a.m., all the results were there. This is the graph. Bang, right? It was amazing and not very expensive. What did I find out? A lot that I found interesting. For example, as you can see, a lot of people overdrink, meaning they drink more than they thought they were going to drink. And they 56% say they usually have a limited mind. 84% are surprised later that it happened, which is a little bit like if I fall down the stairs three times, I'm shocked when the fourth time occurs. 20% said that it happened about half the time, and 31% said they were surprised almost every time. That's the next slide. I'm getting ahead of myself. If you go to the next slide. So this is the percentage of people who, now you notice 16% are never surprised. But of the 56% respondents who reported drinking beyond what they had intended to drink, at least once in a while, 50 were surprised about half the time. So many drinkers also have a limit in mind. This is why I really don't like the federal government being the only one who sets the limit. Particularly in New York, many people just, they laugh at those limits. But they themselves have an idea of how much they're going to drink. And this research, 86% said they exceeded their limit at least once in a while. Next slide, please. Let's see. So this, I can't see what the slide number is. Oh, okay. I got it. I found it. So in 1985, some of you know, Alan Marlatt published a book called Relapse Prevention with his wife. Thankfully, there was no social media at that time, because Alan was a very warm, kind individual, and he was attacked from practically every angle, because he suggested, number one, that he noticed that most people relapsed on their way to recovery. And if they relapsed, then we should train them or try to give them the skills so they wouldn't relapse. Well, to many, 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 many people, that meant he was licensing relapse. He was saying, you're going to relapse, so you might as well go out and do it. Just completely crazy. And he was really hammered for that. In the book, he suggested 8 triggers for relapse. For example, internal affect, negative affect, for example, or obviously interpersonal stress. The way I see relapse is a bit different. For something to happen, it usually takes a number of factors to come together at the same time in the right way. For example, if you want a fire, you need fuel, heat, and oxygen. One time I tried to start a fire in a house that it was 22 degrees below zero. It's really very hard to get wood to burn when the wood is 22 degrees below zero. You have to put a heck of a lot of newspaper on. If you don't want a fire, what do? You take the fuel away, or you pour water on the fire, that takes the heat away, or you throw a blanket on it, or you spray it with some chemical and you take the oxygen away. The same thing happens to be true for a tornado. The sky can look dreadful out where Bruce lives, and it looks like, oh my God, all hell's going to break loose. But nothing happens, because one of these factors was not there. Now, we don't know how to eliminate one of those factors yet. I don't think we ever will. But we're getting better at being able to predict tornadoes because we know how much instability, how much moisture, how much lift, and how much shear is in the neighborhood. Next slide, please. So in another article, I looked at, okay, so what are the possible factors that could trigger a surprise? And one of them I noticed was fatigue. As people go through the week, they get tireder, and there's a lot of literature that shows you do not make the good decisions when you're tired. It also turns out that the time of day, most of the people I work with don't drink at 11 a.m. in the morning. Maybe on Saturday they go for brunch, but generally no. And so they can do very well until about 8 p.m. And the new research on mind wandering that shows when you're kind of just let your mind wander, your affect tends to go south, and your thinking, both together, may give me give us a tip as to what happens. Why did they have such a good day, and then at 8 p.m. they finally throw in the towel and call the liquor store? People in New York drink more on Thursday than on Wednesday, more on Friday than on Thursday, more on Saturday than on Friday, and much, much less on Sunday. So if we know what the day is, and we know the time of day, and we know how tired they are, and my son built me an app using my Fitbit data so I can see how sleep deprived I am by Thursday. If we know where you are, which of course we can know, and if Joe's bar is the place you tend to get in trouble, or being alone in your apartment, that would help. Metastability, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, and then of course beliefs, automatic thoughts, and something that CBT people don't talk enough about in aesthetics and identities. Nobody in my office has ever changed their behavior, let's say, given up cocaine, without first realizing they wanted to be a better dad or a better husband or a better entrepreneur. I want to make one guy quit drinking alcohol because he wanted to have an advantage on everybody, and now he's making about $1 million a year. I would like a small percentage every year. That'd be helpful. Anyway, I hope those of you who don't know me out there, I like to joke. And sometimes, as my wife would tell me, my jokes are not quite on the money. In any case, let's talk about metastability. It is a wonderful concept. It suggests that a system may look stable, but it's not, which is kind of in line with my clients, what my clients report. Everything was going along fine. I don't know what the hell happened. First thing I knew, I blacked out. First thing I knew, I fell down the stairs. I don't know. When you think about metastability, think about mountains and avalanches. Everything looks very stable. Then a very small stimulus, could be a pistol shot, could be one single skier, and the whole side of the mountain collapses. And then everything looks stable again. If another good example, in my opinion, is you take rice, take a bag of rice, drop a kernel of rice onto the table, do it again and again and again. Eventually, you're going to have a little mound of rice. Then you take the exact same stimulus, one kernel of rice, you drop it on the mound, and suddenly, poof, there's this change, a little avalanche of rice. Robert West in London, who's written a book on addictions, has a theory that I personally like a lot. He's talked and written about the impact of metastability on addictions, as well as other people. West argues that our brains are inherently instable, which is interesting because the Buddha said practically the same thing 2,500 years ago. I just find that interesting. But in any case, there's an advantage if we think of neuromodular networks driving the car, let's say, and then you have another one talking to your neighbor, the person sitting in the passenger seat, and you're both hopefully wearing masks. But in any case, you're driving down the road, and the reason it has to be instable and not really stable is suddenly a truck lurches out from the side, and you have to quickly, very quickly, you've got only microseconds, the modular networks that's driving the cars take over and swerve, otherwise you're dead. So it's inherently valuable from an evolutionary standpoint to have the brain kind of instable. But of course, if you add, you know, three glasses of Jack Daniels, things may get very unstable with consequences that are going to be very negative for you. And you don't know what happened. So I always talk to my clients about this, try to help them understand it from a kind of lay standpoint. But also the fact that many of my clients, they can go out 20 days and everything's fine. And then the 21st day, all hell breaks loose. Now, if those of us who know randomness, we know, for example, that the Challenger, the rocket, when it blew up, they knew at NASA that there was a 1 in 26 chance of it blowing up. I don't know about you. I thought it was like kind of a bus. So it was a shock. They worked on it, and they got it after 2 years to 1 in 65 chances. They were lucky. Not another vehicle blew up. Those of you who understand randomness know that it could have been vehicle number one and vehicle number two and still been one out of 65. So how can we help people deal with this? Next slide, please. Yes, I'm aware. I've got a great Fitbit. Mine says 51, but it's okay. Thank you, though. So fortunately, we have had revolutionary changes in psychotherapy and modern psychotherapy. It's not like traditional psychotherapy, even though many people in New York have not, I don't know, they need to get on a train. We know that CBT is the norm. We know that most sessions are structured. We know, I think most of you who do work with people who have addictive problems, it's a little small talk, which is really you're assessing them. Then you find out what happened between sessions, which is more important, by the way, than what happens in sessions. So let me stick to this. Three, modern therapy is future-oriented and goal-focused. Traditional therapy was past-focused. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. There we go. That was because there was this belief that insight would do the trick. If we just got insight into the trauma, and I'm not saying it's not helpful, but it's not sufficient. I'm not even sure it's necessary to use those two terms that Rogers used. And insight is not the primary focus in most modern therapy sessions. The development of skills and tools to help people, for example, manage distress tolerance. Also, modern therapy is collaborative. The old form, particularly psychoanalysis, only the doctor could know. You couldn't know by theory. By their model, you couldn't know. The focus is less on curing pathologies and more on helping people live fuller lives. Next. It didn't click. Oh, Bruce, it's the same slide, at least on me. I don't know. Number eight is the between session. Your internet connection is unstable. Whoa, okay. Between session important as in-session work, self-help has continued to grow as a means of self-guided change, and of course, neuroscience, et cetera, et cetera. Next slide, because I don't want to run out of time. And three other significant changes you can read as easily as I can, but briefer therapy. There's even an annual conference of people who do single session therapy. Next, please. Next, please. You can go to the next one. That's just a summary. So I have two advertisements. Number one, a lot of people ask me questions. I don't back up one if you can. I don't have time to answer all the questions. So finally, I put them into a book. Am I addicted? The original title was, Are You Addicted? And Reed Hester was kind enough to point out that that just would make people defensive. So in any case, a number of people, Division 50 people, kindly have written some nice blurbs for it. It's research-based. Every one of the 64 chapters has suggestions for change. And I think it will be helpful for people who either can't afford therapy or trying to get answers on their own. Next one, please. Finally, when March hit, the pandemic hit, I thought, what can I do? I used to be very involved in SMART. I was one of the co-founders a long time ago. And I thought, well, I can run an online meeting because that won't endanger my family and it won't endanger me. And so I started running, and there are now over 3,300 meetings in 20 different countries, not all online, but there's more than 1,000 online meetings. For those of you who are CB therapists out there, you can, these are easy meetings to run. You need to open them, close them, keep them focused on addictions. They're different kinds of meetings, and it would be a wonderful way for you folks, somebody out there, to contribute, considering how bad things are and are obviously getting worse. Next slide. So there's the summary. And the next slide is simply, thank you for giving me the time. I really appreciate it. So maybe you can kill the... screen sharing, and that way I can be more efficient. Yeah, okay. Anybody have any questions?
Comment that Smart Recovery has a training program for people who want to lead meetings is really excellent, and it's self-directed, and it's quick. And anybody with a background in mental health can pick this up pretty easily. So it's it is a great way to contribute in a pro bono way.
Thank you.
So if there are questions, all you need to do is to click on your mute button and unmute yourself and ask away. While people are considering questions, Mickler, if you were asked at a party, what is the main takeaway from all you've seen about recovery? What would you say about I don't know which to call it, spontaneous or
it's quite clear. Actually, most people do change, and we seem to be fixated in the media, movies, TV, on people who don't, who are unfortunately, and by the way, in the 1870s, 1880s, they didn't call people losers, they called them unfortunates, because they honored the fact that fortune played a role in people's lives. So, by the way, Bruce, if somebody doesn't have a question, I really always like, and I should have ended a few minutes early, to get takeaways. What is there some takeaway from this?
You have questions. M.T. Massey has a question. Please jump in.
Hi, Mickler. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good presentation.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask the group here a question. I facilitate two online meetings on the national level for Smart Recovery and have done so. I've done face-to-face meetings. One thing that I tend to use in my toolbox, if you will, is I often make the reference between cessation of cigarette smoking and how it's common for people, if you frame the context of cigarette smoking as a serious, generally long-lasting addiction or habit, most people say yes. I also like to point out as a helper, if you will, that most people stop smoking on their own or with minimal behavior. They don't walk around saying, I'm a recovering smoker. I have to go to smoke enders meetings for the rest of my life. And if they say anything at all, it's generally phrased around something of, I quit smoking years ago. Something like that when it comes up. And I use that as a, to grease the wheel, if you will, to tell people you can do the same thing with more serious substance or behavior addictions as well. Does that sound like anything any of the rest of you use or would be helpful?
Thumbs up. Somebody's giving you a thumbs up there. Tristan Winston has a thumbs up. So you're getting nonverbal yeses.
Thanks.
I had a this is Mark Shanker. I had a professor who at the beginning of every year, he talked to the incoming graduate students and told them the story of a time when somebody had came to see him 20 years after therapy to thank him. And he said, was there anything I said that was really helpful to you? And he said, Do you remember the time when you said every cloud has a silver lining? And he was totally baffled because he practices a very complex form of contextualizing the language therapy. And he would say this to us saying, you never know what you say that might really make a change for somebody. So don't think that just because you're a first year graduate student, you can't help people. And I've taken that with me all the way through.
Thank you so much. I have to be the bad guy here and say we need to stop. Mikker, thank you so much. I'm looking at
thank you again.
I'm looking at the chats, and you have many, many positive comments on them. Thank you all from on behalf of Division 50 of the American Psychological Association, Addiction Psychology. We will be doing this. We'll be getting back on schedule now that we know how well Zoom works. Look for conferences like this on a regular basis, and we being those of us who have put this together, I know are thrilled that you joined us. This is what having a division and networking and learning together should look like when we can't all be together in person. Thank you all, and especially thank you to Dr.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Lise.